The National Broadcasting Company presents The Lives of Great Men, a new series on great leaders in human progress presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author of The Soul of Democracy and many other books. In his talks, Dr. Griggs will build a story of civilization based on outstanding characters through the ages and how each one influenced his own and future times. This evening, Dr. Griggs will discuss Dante, supreme interpreter of the medieval world. We present Edward Howard Griggs.
My friends, from St. Francis initiating the spiritual awakening at the beginning of the 13th century, we turn to the culmination of that epoch and to the world poet Dante, supreme voice of 10 not silent centuries, creator of the Italian language and unifier of Italy, with all great timeless interpreter of the eternal problems of human life. Three dates place Dante in the stream of history. Born in Florence in 1265, exiled in 1302, he died after 19 years of wandering at Ravenna in 1321. Thus, at the close of the 13th century, he was in the middle of the pathway of our life, as the first line of the Divine Comedy states it. The spiritual awakening, centering on the mission of St. Francis, was a profound influence on the artistic and intellectual awakening. As is always the case, a high epoch of art and intellect springing from some deep stirring of the waters of the spirit. The great phase of medieval culture culminated in the period of Dante. All things of time were viewed under the aspect of eternity. A terrible moral dualism prevailed. Sin meant death, and virtue life eternal. Nevertheless, the Greek ideal was never wholly lost. It is evident in the awakening hunger for knowledge, the love of war and adventure, the feudal loyalties and chivalry toward women. The contrasting tendencies found a curious union in the Crusades, religious wars undertaken in the name of the Prince of Peace. Dante is the loftiest expression of both aspects of the Middle Age. He embodies its vast spiritual aspiration, its hunger for mystical union with the divine, its somber moral dualism and sense of sin. His aim in the Divine Comedy is to take every fact of sin and virtue and discover its final working out in the soul of the doer of the deed, pictured on the threefold screen of eternity. At the same time, Dante embodies all that other contrasting phase of medieval life. For the Divine Comedy is not only the greatest of all interpretations of the moral life, but a love poem written to glorify the memory of the woman Dante loved. In Dante's time, all Europe was divided into two political camps. The Guelph party viewed the Pope as supreme head of Christendom and therefore superior to all earthly potentates. The Ghibellines, while recognizing the Pope as Christ's vicar in the spiritual realm, held that the emperor, regarded as legitimate successor to the old Roman Empire, was supreme in the temporal sphere and so coeval with the Pope. In the centuries of this struggle, Italy fell between, and while repeatedly ravaged, her cities were enabled to develop that remarkable individuality which flowered in her art. Florence was far enough from Rome and strong enough in her democratic independence to fear seldom the papal temporal power. On the other hand, she was directly in the path of the emperors when they descended on the south to reclaim the garden of the empire. Her sympathies were thus dominantly Guelph, for the sake of maintaining her own independence. And early in the 13th century, the Ghibelline party was expelled from the city. The party remaining quickly broke into bitterly opposing factions, Neri and Bianchi, the blacks and the whites. This was complicated by the struggle of the lesser with the greater arts, and the streets of Florence were recurringly reddened with blood shed in civil strife. All this was greatly stimulating, but quickly exhausting. The period of artistic awakening for Florence was in Dante's youth. The great structures that adorn Florence today, the cathedral, the Palace of the Signory, the Church of the Dominicans, Santa Maria Novella, that of the Franciscans, Santa Croce, the startling bell tower Giotto raised, were all begun or erected before Dante's exile. Cimabue and his great pupil Giotto were breaking with 1,000 years of religious symbolism in Byzantine art, and expressing the Christian ideas in forms graceful, beautiful, and true to life and nature. In this environment, Dante grew up, a thoughtful lad, tender in relation to his second mother, we have for his youth the strange and beautiful Vita Nuova, written to tell the story of the new life that came to him through love. He relates how love became his Lord at his first sight of Beatrice, the one who makes blessed, so called by many who knew not wherefore. He gives the tender poems love inspired, tells of his device to conceal the real object of his affection and of his consequences, then follows the dream of her death, and not long after, the dream's fulfillment. And the whole city, as well as Dante's heart, was left sorrowing. There's the further story of the Lady of the Consolation, who looked out of the window pitying his distress, of Dante's struggle between the two leadings, with the devotion to Beatrice conquering. It is all of the spirit, with perhaps little dream of earthly fulfillment. The conditions of feudal society, together with the medieval faith, had separated from natural human relations the love that is a pure consecration of the spirit and given it expression above and apart. Our time is turning away from this to the more natural and biological aspects of the love relationship. What would happen should we lose entirely the consecration of the spirit and the worship of woman? At the close of the Vita Nuova, Dante tells of a vision that came to him so wonderful that he vowed to write no more of her until he could write more worthily. To this end, he says, I labor all I can, and it is my hope that I shall yet write concerning her what hath not before been written of any woman. That vision was undoubtedly the first conception of the Divine Comedy. After Beatrice's death, Dante turned to philosophy and statesmanship, married Gemma Donati and had a considerable family of children. He advanced in public affairs and became one of the rulers of the city. Suddenly, with a change in political control, and possibly when he was away on an embassy, Dante was banished from Florence and his property confiscated. So began his 19 years of exile, to end only with his death. At first, he had good hope of return. He joined the exiled Ghibellines, but was so disgusted by their tactics that he was compelled, he tells us, to make a party by himself, a conclusion to which many an honest man has been driven in later political life. In a letter to a Florentine friend explaining why he could not take advantage of a law just passed, permitting exiles to return as pardoned criminals under certain degrading conditions, Dante says, This is not the way to return to my country, O my father. If another shall be found by you or by others that does not take away from the fame and honor of Dante, that I will take with no lagging steps. But if Florence is entered by no such path, then never will I enter Florence. What? Can I not elsewhere look upon the face of the sun and the stars? Can I not anywhere under the heavens meditate upon most sweet truths, unless I first make myself inglorious, nay, ignominious, to the people and the state of Florence? Nor indeed will bread be lacking. Nor indeed was bread lacking. But alas, it was the too soft bread of patronage he ate by climbing other people's stairs with none of his own to climb. When the Emperor Henry VII descended upon Italy, Dante wrote letters to the Florentines urging them to submit to their lawful overlord. This offended freedom-loving Florence and lessened his chance of return. To understand his action, turn to his treatise on monarchy, where Dante develops his political philosophy. He believed that lasting peace could come only if Europe became a sort of crowned republic of nations, with the emperor, Christ's vicar in the temporal field, as the pope was in the spiritual. Dante, as excoriating passages in the Divine Comedy show, was bitterly opposed to the temporal power of the papacy, regarding it as chief cause of the evils that had come in the history of the church. The treatise on monarchy, by the way, is the one of Dante's works afterwards placed on the index. So the wandering exile continued. Dante refused the laurel crown in several cities, always hoping to receive it in Florence. In a northern city, he was walking slowly with bowed head in a monastery cloister. A brother approached and asked, Stranger, what seekest thou? Dante lifted his head, and with a voice that echoes poignantly across the centuries, answered, Peace. He did not find the peace, wandering on and on. Finally, he settled in Ravenna as guest of Guido da Polenta, lord of the city, perhaps living in the very house from which Francesca da Rimini, whom he sadly celebrates, had gone out as bride of the cruel lord of Rimini. He wandered out from the city to the pine forest along the Adriatic shore, making himself lean, he says, working over the stanzas of his great poem. Out of it all, the homeless exile, the spiritual struggles, the defeated longing, uprose this poem of the earth and air, this medieval miracle of song. For Dante, the Divine Comedy was another way of life through which he achieved a moral harmony, the truth that is the saving good of intellect, the love and wisdom, the peace that in the world he sought in vain. For Dante, preeminently, art was for life's sake. Among the great masters, Dante is thus distinguished by his profoundly earnest ethical aim. I suppose no other world poet ever began with such a statement as Dante makes in his letter to Con Grande della Scala, to whom he dedicated the Paradiso, saying that the work, if considered in its allegorical meaning, the subject is man, liable to the reward or punishment of justice. Now, the kind of philosophy under which we proceed is moral philosophy, because the whole was undertaken not for speculation, but for practice, to find the redeeming truth for himself and show the way to others. Such was his aim. Dante rigidly observes the curb of art, which so much modern verse carelessly ignores. He carries it into the mathematical structure of the poem and to the verse form, that Italian terza rima, itself a symbol of the Trinity. Beginning in the dark forest of doubt and questioning, because of a disordered world, with evil in high places and good oppressed, Dante's problem in the Divine Comedy is to find the moral harmony proving this to be God's world. To discover it, his pilgrimage takes him through the three spheres, in each of which a saving truth is taught. In the Inferno, sobbed out in the moan of Francesca da Rimini, hissed through the shut teeth of Ugolino, voiced in the multitudinous wailing of the lost, is just one lesson. Sin is death. So in the Purgatorio, taught by the figures on the pavement and the statues on the walls, by the voices in the air and the songs that greet Dante as he climbs, is again one lesson. Sin repented of may become education. In the Paradiso, revealed in the light multiplied into light, in the exultant songs of the redeemed, in the teachings from the beloved lips of the regained Beatrice, is once more a crowning lesson, that life means the spontaneous reception of God's light and love as these irradiate the spiritual universe. These are the saving truths that put moral harmony into the seeming chaos of life, revealing the inexorable but beneficent laws that make this world God's world. Thus the poem rises to the music of the sublime, Dante annulling image with ever higher image in the effort to portray the transcendent, until he attains that acme of medieval aspiration, the momentary beatific vision of God. In that instant he saw, bound up by love together in one volume, what through the universe in leaves is scattered. The highest poet, the Italians justly call him. As for Dante, his poem was another way of life, through which he achieved those ends of the spirit he sought in the world in vain. So is it for us who follow in his footsteps. If we can face our still more disordered world with something of his tragic earnestness, if we also will view the things of time under the aspect of eternity, if we will climb with him the mountain of purification, wander with him in the garden of rest and peace, take our flight to the heaven of light multiplied into light and music deepening to celestial harmony, for us as for Dante, the Divine Comedy will prove to be art for life's sake.
Dante, supreme interpreter of the medieval world, has been the subject of this second program in a new series titled Lives of Great Men, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author. Copies of last week's talk on St. Francis of Assisi and tonight's discussion of Dante may be obtained by addressing the National Broadcasting Company, Radio City, New York, or the station to which you are listening. This broadcast has reached you from the studios of WDAF, Kansas City, through the National Broadcasting Company.